Hi there, I'm Rory O'Connor, Professor of Health Psychology and a Mental Health Researcher at the University of Glasgow.
And I'm Craig, a filmmaker and content creator at MQ Mental Health Research.
And welcome to MQ Open Mind, a podcast that brings together lived experience with scientific research to help us to better understand mental health problems. And we hope to do so in a way that is accessible to all.
In this episode, we speak to the CEO of Peopleful, Georgie Mack, and Head of Data Analysis and Insight at Peopleful, Dr. Kate Duckworth. MQ Mental Health Research joined forces with Peopleful and the Workwell Research Centre at Northwest University to conduct a cross-industry study of workplace dynamics across the UK and Ireland. The aim is to develop a framework that will help leaders to build more mentally healthy workplaces that deliver better outcomes for their people that, in turn, boost their organization's performance. In this conversation, we discuss the Building Mentally Healthy Workplace Report, how organizations can support their staff's mental health, and understanding the truth about burnout.
Welcome to the latest episode of MQ's podcast, Open Mind. And Craig and I are delighted we've got two fantastic guests. Once again, we've got Georgie Mack, and we've got Dr. Kate Duckworth, and they're with Peopleful, what we'll hear a lot about in a second. And welcome both Georgie and Kate to the podcast. Thanks a million for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Welcome in.
So maybe we begin. So Georgie, you're CEO. Can you tell us a bit about your journey? First of all, your journey, how you got there and your sort of interest in mental health in this context, mental health in the workplace, because the focus of obviously the episode today is really trying to look at workplace mental health and particular burnout. We'll focus on that later in the podcast. So Georgie, over to you.
Okay, so I was, it was quite a while ago. I was working for an amazing organization called IDEO, and we were working on a project to try and get people in the workplace more physically active. And as part of that, I met an amazing character called Professor Steve Feast. He was an advisor for the Department of Health, cabinet officer, medical director, like an incredible background. And I was interviewing him and he said, I just wish that, you know, an organization like IDEO would go and look into what's going on in the mental health landscape, because honestly, the stats are absolutely petrifying. And the workplace is such a powerful touch point to try and catalyze some change. And so really, it was as simple as that. I went and looked into it. I looked at the stats. I thought, I cannot believe this isn't being talked about more. And I really think we need to proactively go out in the world and try and get organizations to take this topic more seriously. And as a result of that, I met a gentleman called Jeff McDonald. He was the global VP of HR at Unilever. His own journey, he's a big crusader around mental health. And we set up a charity called Minds at Work, which was all around destigmatizing mental health in the workplace. And really, that was kind of, I had a day job still in innovation consultancy. The pandemic came along. Suddenly, the world and his or her wife got very interested in well-being at work. And you just couldn't move for the amount of interventions and activities happening in this area. But what really struck me was you never heard a thing about ROI. You never understood whether any of these wonderful sounding interventions were actually effective. Did they make any difference to anybody? You never heard about the commerciality of any of it. So, you know, what's it actually doing from a business perspective? And you very rarely heard about the role that the workplace was playing in all of this. So lots of empowering individuals to look after their own mental health and well-being. But actually, what role is the organization playing? And are people even trying to understand that? So that's kind of the background. Mm-hmm. And then we were introduced to a brilliant team of academics in South Africa, Northwest University, the Workwell Research Unit, incredible diagnostics that I hadn't encountered or heard anything quite like them before. And there was the opportunity to set up Peopleful around those diagnostics. So that's really the journey that brings us up to date today.
Yeah, no, that's a great overview. And we'll come back to obviously the what Peopleful does and their aspirations and the partnership, the report that you recently published, I think it was last September, or September just passed there, and with MQ. So we'll come back to that, but really helpful. So we're going to cross time zones now, and we're going now to, so Kate, you obviously, Georgie's mentioned Northwest and mentioned South Africa. So you are currently in South Africa. So it'd be great to an introduction, your sort of background in mental health psychology, how you got to where you are.
So lean into mental health has come kind of latterly in my career. I've worked in education research for the large part of my career, my PhD, and then 14, 15 years at the Institute of Education, and really looking at how education develops from kind of cradle to grave, really, and the role that mental health and the socio-emotional skill development has always just, it always just runs alongside. It doesn't matter whether you're looking at economic outcomes or education outcomes, it's always part of the developmental process. It's always a huge predictor of how well people do and don't do. And it's so intertwined with developmental shifts in age. And so it's always kind of been part and parcel of what I've done, sitting in the background. And then when I moved over to South Africa, I had my own health issues, which led to some of my own mental health issues. And so wanting to be kind of more involved in that space and direct my research more to looking at how you can destigmatize, how you can remedy it, how you can research it well and properly, and not just quick questionnaires here and there on how you're feeling, but actually proper measurement, proper assessment. And I was introduced to Georgie and here we are.
Yeah, that's a wee trip. We'll come back to you, Georgie, but the thing I've just discovered for the listeners or viewers is that apparently I was a Kate's lecturer in 1999, did you say?
1999, yeah.
1999.
University.
Yeah, when I must have been 8 or 12, so 27 or something like that. So, 26, even younger. And obviously, I haven't aged a bit, is what you're meant to say.
No, not at all. Not at all.
I had long dark hair then. I did have long dark hair then.
You did.
So very different. Anyway, that's a bit of an aside. So, Georgie, back to you then. Tell us a bit then. So I didn't quite catch when was PeopleFull established? How long are you going?
We're in our third year. We're nearly at the end of our third year. So we've been, you know, on a kind of mission for nearly 3 years, and it's an interesting and very challenging market.
So can you tell us a bit about, so what's your aspiration for it? And so I know there's a report we're going to talk about. Before we go into the report, I'm just keen to sort of see how in the last 3 years, what have you done basically? Because I mean, a lot on the website looks really impressive. So I'm just trying to understand for the people who are less familiar with it, what your aspirations, what you've done.
Yeah, well, I guess what we've been trying to do is make as much noise as we possibly can about the role that the organization plays in mental health and well-being. And it's, you know, it's really hard. There's a lot of reports out there. And I think one of the challenges is that it still doesn't seem to be landing in the way that one hopes, that we're still not catalyzing change as fast as one should. And, you know, I mean, we're going to come on to our report and some of the stats in there. But I mean, if you look at any of the big reports out there, whether it's McKinsey or Deloitte or Gallup or whatever, they're all corroborating the same story. And, you know, there are some quite alarming things. Like, I'm always very struck by one of the stats, which is, you know, that it was a study carried across 15 different countries, and toxic workplaces are the number one reason for poor employee outcomes. And, you know, and toxicity where people aren't being recognized, where there's a culture of bullying and favoritism. And it sometimes still feels that, you know, that we're in the dark ages when it comes to thinking about humanizing workplaces. And I think one of the things that we've been trying to do is talk about the word well-being, which is such a loaded and dangerous word. It's one of those words that started to just become so blurry around the edges, it doesn't really carry as much meaning as it deserves to anymore. So I think there's a lot of organizations out there who are well-intentioned, but think that, you know, if you do well-being, if you put well-being into an organization, somehow you're going to get well-being out, like some kind of well-being sausage factory. And I think it's more around, if only the organization could understand better that it plays a huge role in all of this, and that if you measure it, if you understand what's driving what in the workplace, you're actually able to do something about it. And if you can create happier employees that go back to their families and to their friends, you know, arguably, and this is why I think the workplace is such a powerful touch point, you can start touching things on a more kind of population level. It's not just about the workplace. It has a bigger implication than just the workplace. So that's the kind of job we're trying to do, I guess.
Yeah. No, I'm not struck me. A lot of things strikes me is why I do work on suicide. And it always continually amazes me that we don't do enough still in the workplace. And that's changing for suicide prevention. Now, I think mental health broadly has moved forward faster than suicide prevention in the workplace specifically. But it always surprises me because, and you just made this point in a way, which is most people who die by suicide are working at the time of death. Right? Yeah. They may be on sick leave, but over 60%, 67%, 68% in the UK, we should be doing so much more in this space. Now, it's fear often is part of the reason for suicide prevention. Now, with mental health, I think more broadly, I think initially it was a bit of fear and a bit of misunderstanding, but I think it's great to see the progress in some organizations like yours and are obviously trying to harness that. But I was just curious, one thing you said, though, George, you said well-being was a dangerous word. So I'm just curious, so can you unpack that? Because I wouldn't see it as a dangerous word.
Okay, maybe, yes, maybe the word dangerous was a little over the top. I just think it started to, I mean, there are so many well-being providers out there for a start. You can hardly move. I think it's very difficult for organizations to know how to navigate that landscape. Who should you go with? Who should you kind of hook your wagon to in terms of well-being? But I guess because, I mean, for example, you can go to well-being conferences and you listen to people go up on the stage and talk about the great things that they're doing. And they do sound like they're great things, but you never hear about the ROI. And at the end of the day, we are talking about a business context. And I think there is quite
a... Hold on, for the listener, what's ROI stand for?
Return on investment. But I think there is a sort of squeamishness around talking about commercial things in the context of well-being. And I think that's a little bit of a mistake, because at the end of the day, if we're going to try and make a difference, bringing that economic story into play is, I think, a really important part of it. And there's a really inspirational chief people officer at the Bank of Ireland called Matt Elliott, who talks about being commercial and caring, and that actually they are excellent bedfellows. And for me, that absolutely nails it. So it's, you know, it's this, I suppose, this absence of the economic story, the absence of ROI, the fact that well-being, it's such a broad, vast term. I mean, what does it actually cover? So you can hide behind all sorts of things in well-being. And I guess that's why I said dangerous, although that's quite a loaded word in its own right.
It also, Georgie, the well-being piece of it also puts the onus on the individual that they have to fix themselves, and it becomes a very personalized, you need to have this help and you need to have this support because there's something wrong with you, rather than burnout, which is an occupational phenomenon. It has its complete roots in the organization. And by making it more about well-being and less about burnout and stress-related ill health that's from the workplace context, you're taking the kind of the causal factors out of it. So that burnout is caused by the workplace. It's not caused by the individual. And so it's trying to make the solution part of the occupational piece of it, rather than putting it all at the door of the individual.
Well, I think that's a really great point. Obviously, that important of taking a systemic organizational approach. And it often reminds me, what you just said, Kate, reminds me of, we sometimes talk about resilience. Mm-hmm. And so there's different ways in which you can talk about resilience, of course, but often, I think it's too often that resilience is basically placed at the door of the person to have to respond to awful, in many cases, truly awful life circumstances. And so what we should be doing is creating, in the case of, say, mental health and early intervention, creating a world where young kids aren't experiencing awful trauma that they have to be resilient against. And it's the same idea. I like that, of framing it as, reframing it as not, but it's an individual in context, but their context is an organization here.
Yeah.
The organization has a responsibility, moral responsibility. But of course, the other point I think you're making, Georgie, in terms of return on investment is, it's the right thing to do, but also economically it makes sense.
Yeah.
We'll come back to that in a few minutes when we go into details of the report, because I know you talk about the economic as well as the impact of sort of stress and burnout.
I was going to say, can I just mention the MQ link? And then, I mean, Kate's the author of the report and has done an amazing job, so she should 100% be talking about that. But I just thought briefly, the link with MQ. So when MQ first came into being, and I was trying to more proactive, taking this proactive approach to workplace mental health. So met MQ very early on and had conversations. And so it kind of felt, when Peopleful came into being, it just felt like a really natural link to pick up that conversation. So that's exactly what we did. And it coincided with the fact that MQ was thinking more about workplace mental health and that whole territory. And you were looking for a partner that could bring measurement and bring an evidence base to the workplace wellbeing story. And that's how the conversation began. And then the idea of this report and trying to put evidence out into the world came into being. And so that's where the MQ link has come from.
Great. So then that's really helpful, Georgie. So Kate, over to you then. Can you tell us then a bit about, so this MQ report was published, workplace mental health. Do you want to tell us a bit about what you did, and what you found? And then we can maybe talk about the broader aspects.
So the report we published in September is the first report. The idea is that we're going to do this assessment again and again and highlight the importance of the longitudinal piece, so looking at change over time. We wanted to get a kind of baseline measurement of the state and mood of employees as we're kind of emerging from a pandemic. So we used our assessments and our model, and I'll talk a bit about that in a second, to understand and help MQ to develop their sort of thinking around the evidence base for approach to mental health. And we have got data on about 5,500 employees from 15 different organizations across the UK and Ireland. They took our assessment largely in 2022, and we compare their data with our bank of data, our kind of trends data that we've been developing for the last two decades. We focus it on a period from kind of 2020 to 2021, sort of earlier in the pandemic, so that we can kind of get an assessment of how they compare with what looks to be average at the beginning of the pandemic, and say kind of what the changes are. And then the idea is that we'll keep on looking at that, so we can look at the common sample over time, we can look at how things are changing and how things are developing. The approach we use is the theoretical framework of Bakker and Zamariti, the jobs demands, job resources theoretical framework. So the idea being that you can exist in a highly demanding workplace as long as you've got the supports in place, and it's the balance of those two things that help to fuel the energy and motivation of individuals in the workplace. So the energy being I can do this, and the motivation being I want to do this. And part of the understanding of sort of the burnout and the stress-related ill health piece of it is that as you start to become burnt out, your energy depletes, your motivation goes down. It's not just a black and white binary state of something that you either have or don't have burnout or stress-related ill health. It kind of happens over time that gradually your energy depletes, you become more and more exhausted, you become more cynical, you start to question your own value in the organization, the resilience piece you were talking about. You know, that's those things start to just erode. And so we look at the kind of both the energy side of the equation and the motivational side of the equation to understand the incidence of different aspects of work-related well-being, as incidence of turnover and tension. And so we measure it from the kind of what's happening in the workplace, the experience of the workplace climate and culture, the stress-related ill health and burnout piece, and then the impact that that's having on both individuals and organizations. So we take a kind of holistic view, both of the organization, but also the process of what's happening.
Yeah. And so before we get into the details of what you find, so in the report, you have the sort of well-being spectrum. So you go from, obviously, from sense of purpose and mastery right through to worthlessness and hopelessness. And so am I right in thinking that what you've just said? So you've got benchmark data from over the last 20 years of is on those sorts of indicators as well. And then you're obviously, what you're going to tell us about are, not only will we have the absolute numbers, but we'll be able to compare it over the last number of years. So how did you get did you say 15 organizations?
Yeah, 15 organizations, 5,500 employees. So some of the organizations are a little bit bigger and some of them are smaller, and they come from different sectors. So financial services, we've got some hospitality industry in there, we've got insurance companies, just different kinds of organizations.
And what country? What country, to tell us where they're?
They are from across the UK and Ireland.
Yeah, so they're all UK and Ireland. Sorry, I know, I think Georgie said that. So tell us in a bit about what did you find then? So, or first of all, what did you assess? Can you talk about the assessment? So what did you, and then what were your sort of headline? I know there's some really stark headline figures on burnout. But maybe if that'd be great, Kate, if you could tell us a bit about that, your key messages.
So the assessment, it's been, you know, kind of years in the making. It's underpinned by lots of scientifically valid assessments and dimensions and things. And so, you know, burnout being a key one of them, which is recognized by the World Health Organization as a chronic workplace stress that's been resulted from stress in the workplace that hasn't been well managed. It's not it's not just feeling a bit rubbish. It's not just feeling a bit overwhelmed. It's a proper syndrome that has been recognized. And we separate it out from stress-related ill health, where you can have stress if you're burnt out, but the aspects of psychological and physical ill health that has its roots in other places other than the workplace, so finances and family and genetics and other aspects that can cause stress-related ill health. But the burnout piece is, it's caused by the workplace, and that's so we want to be able to say to organizations, this is how you can kind of separate these out, and this is what's causing burnout in your organization. So we have this large data that we've pulled everything together, and that's what the report is based on, these 5,500 individuals. But the all participating organizations that did the assessment, we gave them their own reports so that they can understand their specific context and so this is the kind of average aggregated data across all of the all of the people.
Can I just jump in there for one second, because you just mentioned two things there, which I was really curious at when I looked at the report, which is, so you mentioned there the burnout, you've got the those who are at high risk of burnout, and then you've got those who've got stress related ill health. And what was really interesting, he's a really fascinating figure in there, in which you look at the trajectory over the lifespan. And I was just really curious. And I think answered this question you looked at when you talked about the different sources of stress, obviously. Mm-hmm. But for those of you who haven't read the report, so if my interpretation or my understanding of reading the figure is that, so the people with stress-related ill health, it seems to be highest in younger people, right? So it's highest in 20 to 29. And then it then decreases pretty steadily right through to the 60 plus.
Yeah.
Whereas, by contrast, you see a different pattern in the burnout risk, which is it's slightly lower in the 20 to 29. And then interestingly, it increases in your 30s, but remains stable, pretty stable through to your 50, and then starts decreasing. So it'd be really interesting. So what's your sense of those data, Kate, in terms of an explanation? Is it because in part you mentioned that obviously the burnout one is directly related to the workforce and you can sort of see why that might escalate as you maybe, I don't know, get more senior in an organization. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Whereas the life stress stuff, we all have that. And it's maybe how we respond to it change. It decreases over the lifespan. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same kind of replicated in some of the other studies as well, that the stress-related ill health tends to be a bit higher in the younger cohorts. They've got different pressures, other things going on, more financial concerns, more concerns about moving into independent living, family stresses, debt stresses, environmental stresses, and global societal things that are, you know, having a differential impact for the younger cohorts. And then the older, what's interesting is that, as you said, the cross-sectional image of the cohorts is much, much higher, particularly amongst the 20 to 29-year-olds. Mm. And the burnout is much, much flatter. It does go up sort of in the kind of middle cohorts. And you're right, it is because there's more work stuff going on. There's more probably senior, more managing responsibilities sandwiched between the kind of senior people and the lower people. But what we find that's really interesting is that when we compare the research for that we used in this study and compared that with our trend data, that we see the similar patterns of the stress-related ill health in that data, so it's higher among younger people, but it didn't really change during the course of the pandemic, the stress-related ill health piece. The burnout piece changed dramatically. It's almost doubled from the beginning of the pandemic to the data that we have in terms of the incidence of it. It goes from, I think, about 13% in the average data to about 23%. So it's, you know, it's gone up considerably, whereas the stress-related ill health is about just over 1 in 5 people on the average. It's higher for the younger cohorts, but it's the burnout piece that has really massively increased during the pandemic, and we'll only time will tell to see whether that's going to diminish as we kind of emerge from it and the workplace adjusts to a post-COVID world.
Yeah, no, that's really that's concerning, really concerning, the doubling. So just in case we haven't done this already, have we defined burnout? It'd be useful just to be clear on what we mean by burnout. And then the other one I was thinking was, remind us, when were these data collected? What stage of the pandemic was it?
towards the end of it, so kind of the latter half of 2022.
Okay.
As things, I mean, we were still in it. We were still masked up and we were still in restrictions, but we had been kind of going through it for, we'd been homeschooling and doing our, you know, those things for a much longer period of time and kind of enduring it rather than kind of at the beginning of it and not, which is when we're, the data we're comparing to. We're comparing to data that was kind of 2020, the beginning of 2021, with mm-hmm. data that was much later in 2022.
And then just on that definition of burnout, then, so what?
Burnout is a syndrome that is, it results from chronic workplace stress that's not been successfully managed. Mm-hmm. That's the World Health Organization's definition of it. It's characterized by exhaustion, so energy depletion, whether that's mental, physical, or emotional. It's disengagement, mental distance, negative feelings towards the workplace, your role, your colleagues, and it's kind of reduced personal efficacy. So feeling despondent, low self-worth, absence of or lowering of resilience levels, which are known to kind of bolster those kind of energy and motivation pieces that if you've got good resilience levels that can help you carry yourself through. But it's that real kind of chronic workplace stress that's just not been dealt with over time. And it can be a clinical burnout, very, very serious clinical burnout that's been left and left, which can result in very serious physical and long-lasting psychological damage. It can take up to 4 years to recover from.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very, it can be a completely debilitating experience, and it creeps up on you. People don't, I think people often think, and I know this is the case with, you know, all areas of mental health, and I think that burnout is something that hasn't been sort of viewed in the same sphere. It sort of, it often gets kind of an umbrella term catch-all for general malaise that people are feeling a bit stressed out at work, but it's not. It's actually something that is clinically quite distinct from, mm-hmm. and it all too often gets kind of caught up in a kind of catch-all.
And I think at that point, we've probably spent too long not taking it seriously enough, arguably.
Yeah.
So then moving on then, Kate, then, so the next bit of the report then is obviously the role of the workplace. So mm-hmm. So burnout and risk of burnout is a real issue. So in terms of what did you find, what are the key drivers, do we think, to that?
Oh, in our data, the key drivers of the three main key drivers of burnout. One is workload, the kind of the quantity of work that you've got to do and the time you need to do it in. Which might sound kind of obvious, but what we are able to do is kind of peel back the layers of what's causing what. And mm-hmm. workload isn't just a matter of more bums on seats or hiring more people to do the work. It's most closely associated with systems and equipment frustration. So people don't have the necessary tools to do their job. And that might look different in a hospitality sector where the washing machine, the dishwashers don't work and the tills don't work, or in a call center where the phones don't work. And so you're frustrated that the systems and equipment you have isn't fit for purpose, so you can't do your job. You still got to do the same amount of work in the same amount of time, but now you've had 2 hours down because the servers have gone down again and you can't connect to the desktop that you need to. And so we try and unpack the drivers. So the key one is workload and understanding that. Low workload can also be a problem. People where there isn't sufficient delegation and people have too little work and they can actually get overly bored, and then you get sort of almost burnout through boredom because people are just feeling mm-hmm. Undervalued and underutilized. Another key driver of burnout, stress-related ill health is, it's called person job fit. It's how I see myself and what I'm doing, and do those things match? And if there isn't a good fit between how I see myself, what I'm supposed to be doing in my job, the job I thought I was signing up for when I, you know, started, those don't match, and I'm not being asked to do other things, and that isn't my job. And over time, those things become more and more stressful because you're not mm-hmm. doing what you thought you were going to be doing, and it's not where you kind of see yourself going in your career. So that's a key piece of it, of the puzzle as well. That then impacts on your perceived competence and your self-efficacy and all of these things that kind of slowly begin to unravel. And then the other one is this sort of the emotional load, the toxic workplace and dealing with difficult people and difficult situations and the eroding impact that can have on people as well.
So then, so based on your findings and those three top, I know there's many other factors contribute to a lower degree or less of a degree. So what's your key message to organizations and our employers? What, based on your findings, what should they be doing to improve the workplace? And maybe both of you, maybe Kate, if you mm-hmm. kick off on that one, maybe Georgie, also you come in on that. So what we can think, what organizations should be doing?
So measuring it is something that you won't be that surprised to hear us say. There was a great quote I had from last year, which was, you need to collect the dots in order to connect the dots. So I think measurement plays a huge role and really thinking harder. I mean, organizations aren't used to measuring the sorts of things that we're measuring. And I do think it does require some courage to look in the mirror in the way that our diagnostics do. So that's one important thing. It requires courage, but I think it's really, really necessary. The big message I would say to organizations is that if you can start digging into the causes that sit behind this, you don't need to invest in these sort of seismic interventions. I think one of the things that we really believe at Peopleful is that if you can get to the root causes, if you can understand the drivers and actually work with the people who are most impacted by those things, that actually lots of small changes done in many places can start making a difference to the experience of that particular workplace. And also, we know that organizations are really constrained in terms of budget and how much money they can spend on topics like this. So if you can get real precision, really signpost where people are being most affected and focus in on those areas first with these small changes and kind of, you know, the word co-creation is one of those words that makes me sometimes slightly shudder, but work with people who are best placed to help you think about how you might be able to shore up the damage or the impact that that situation is creating is a really, really powerful way to start making a difference. And I think that message would be something I'd really like for organizations to hear.
But are organizations hearing the message though? I mean, even when I think of organizations I've worked with, there's been a huge change in the last 10 years, I would say 10, 15 years, and willingness and openness to really embrace and trying to have a mentally healthier workplaces. But are you seeing on the ground, are you seeing change, Georgie?
I'm not fast enough, if I'm being honest. I think I was at a conference the other day with a panel and someone reminded me of this. And it was a little bit of a wake up call, which is sometimes I think if you're very kind of fervent about a topic like this, you tend to hang out with quite like-minded people. You tend to go to conferences where you're talking to the converted, etc. And anyway, one of the gentlemen on my panel had posted on LinkedIn this piece from TikTok, and it was about a certain well-known person talking about how people just need to man up and stop being snowflakes, et cetera, et cetera. And he posted it.
We all know who that might be.
Do you? Anyway, he posted it thinking that, you know, that it would, you know, that people would be agreeing with him, that it was shocking that certain people thought like this. But he was really, really taken aback by the amount of people who went, I agree with that, you know, mental ill health, it's the new backache and this kind of thing. And what you realize is that there is an enormous swathe of people out there who are not buying into this in the same way. And so there's, you know, there is a big education piece. But if you look at the data, if you look at our data, if you look at McKinsey's data, you can see that change is not happening fast enough. It simply isn't. And then coupled with that, especially when you know people who've experienced burnout, and it is awful seeing friends and family going through that. I mean, it really is shocking. So change isn't happening fast enough. The message isn't getting out there fast enough. And one of the questions, Craig, that I think you asked us to think about, which is, you know, what answer do you wish research could provide? And one of the things that I wish is that employers, if we could research into why organizations don't do more in this space, given the impact on the bottom line. I would love to get my head around that. I constantly think about that. And I think maybe it's just because organizations, they've just got by in the past. And maybe they're just used to functioning in terms of when it comes to the energy of their people, just in a very mediocre way. We're just very used to mediocrity. That's my little pet theory I'm trotting out on this.
And I think you were saying earlier about, you know, there's we would like to think that people and businesses act morally, that you should want to have a healthy workplace and where people flourish and thrive. And so there's a sort of moral case to act. But all too often, that's quite a dangerous and scary thing to do. And once you know how many people in your organization or the proportion of people in your organization who are at risk of burnout, then you have to do something about it. So yeah. Looking in the mirror is quite an uncomfortable thing to do in many respects. But when you think about when we sort of put the numbers a bit more kind of starkly of saying somebody who's at high risk of burnout costs an organization 11 times more than somebody who's got manageable levels of stress, mm-hmm. measured in terms of their likelihood of leaving, their presenteeism, so their loss in productivity, their absenteeism rates, they cost 11 times more. That's, you know, up to 120,000 £1,000, people who are at high risk of burnout are seven times more likely to leave an organization than somebody who's at manageable levels of stress. And so when it's there's a business case, yeah, we would like to think people would act on the moral case, but what we're trying to also highlight to people is that good business is good business. You know, if you've got a good business, it's good for you and it's good for your people.
Yeah, no, the economic case is so stark, but as you say, I mean, if you're not convinced by the moral case, hopefully, yeah, sometimes it is easier, depending who the audience is, to make the economic case as well. I mean, maybe, Kate, just on the question that Georgie also already answered. So what we asked our guests about, so what do you see as the big question we should be addressing in mental health in the workplace?
It's almost the kind of the flip side of that. It's the valuing of good research. It's measuring it properly and robustly and with valid assessments, and not just gathering data for data's sake, but gathering good data that will help you to understand what's happening in an organization and being able to use that rather than just tick box exercises of make them fill in this and make them fill in this, because employees don't want to fill in 101 different questionnaires and nothing's going to change. People know when workplaces are difficult, and it's really tackling those kind of issues. But it's more, yeah, I think the reverse of it, that people to value, I mean, I would say that I'm a data geek, right? So yeah. The research matters, and measuring it over time and seeing how it changes and understanding it properly is the way we advance our understanding and having a good solid evidence base.
I think that's a really positive message and a really important one. And Dave, one of the things that I take from your conclusions in the report is, I mean, you've a bolded headline, which is the good news is that by monitoring the data, doing all this analysis, then you've got the employers can do so much to solve it. So it's not as if it's a powerless situation. It's economically makes sense, and it's within that domain, that control of organizations.
So yeah, burnout happens in the workplace. So the solution, if it happens in the workplace, the solution has to be there too. So it's absolutely not something just giving somebody a pot of well-being and saying, go and fix yourself. It's saying, what do we need to do in our organization? And that is different in different contexts. It's different for different organizations. This is an aggregated kind of average level overview of what's happening, but it will vary. But it is completely within the power of the organization to solve for these problems.
So how does this report differentiate from other reports that have been done before? Like, what makes this one so special?
Is that we can get into the drivers that sit behind this. And I think, you know, so often the insight slightly falls short. So again, if we think about burnout, most people will default to thinking, well, what drives burnout? It's driven by too much work. But if you start peeling back the layers and understanding what sits behind it, and so I think it's for me, because there are a number of reports out there, it's starting to, what's different about the report is that hopefully it starts to awaken people to the fact that you can go layers behind these terms and these words and kind of go upstream to the root causes, so that you can stop people kind of like jumping in the first place, if that makes sense.
It's the holistic piece of it. You know, you're comparing apples with apples and oranges with oranges, rather than saying, right, we know this about this because we did this assessment over here, and these people told us this and this data. And you're trying to sort of force all these different bits of the puzzle to tell you something, whereas we kind of look at it from end to end and try to understand the whole picture. And what's nice is that our numbers replicate the numbers that are being seen in lots of the other data and other reports talk about, you know, the need to look at what's happening at an organizational level. And we actually do that and try to help organizations, because we want and believe that workplaces should, you know, you spend a third of your life there, 90,000 hours on average in a workplace, and it should be a place where you can thrive and being the best version of yourself to work.
Yeah, excellent. That's a really positive note to almost finish on. So we're almost out of time. We've just got one, we always try and end with a question which is unrelated to the topic in hand. And so, George, I'll go to you first, and the same question will come to you, Kate. It's just a nice reflective question. Which, Georgie, so what advice would you give your 16-year-old self? Now, it can be on anything, any aspect of life and well-being.
If I could go back in time, I would think carefully about the sort of industry sector I was going into the organizations I worked for and look into what they report on, what they measure, what they're proud of. And I know it's that sort of cliche of people treasure what they measure, but I would tell myself to understand that story a lot better, because it's likely, I believe, more likely that you would end up working somewhere where you flourished, where you thrived, where you were energetic and happy.
Okay, I like a good detailed response here. I like that. It's the same question for you. What advice would you give your 16-year-old self?
I think to do what I want to do rather than what I think I should do. I think I've spent a lot of time doing what I think I should have done. And actually one of the best pieces of advice was given to me by, and I can't remember her surname, she was called Alison. She was one of the lecturers that I had at Strathclyde when I did my undergraduate degree. And I said, I don't know what I want to do next. And she said, well, what do you like doing? And I said, well, I like doing research. She said, well, go and do that then. And I said, yeah, but people like me and people from the kind of family I'm from, we don't do masters. We don't go into kind of university type of jobs. And she said, well, go and do that. And it was such a brilliant piece of advice. And I wish I had harnessed that throughout the kind of choices I've made along the road to do what I want and not what I think I should.
I think that's a brilliant way to end the importance of authenticity and just going with your gut in a sense, but yeah, what you want to do. I think that's so, so important. So on that note, just on behalf of Craig and I, Georgie and Kate, thanks so much for taking a part in the podcast. Really looking forward to see, I'm assuming there's going to be the follow-up data, the longitudinal data and time. So no doubt we'll hear about that in due course, but really important work, which I think is really important messages for action. So thanks a million, and full details of the report are on the MQ website, and it's easily accessible to all. Thank you.
MQ Open Mind is presented by MQ Mental Health Research, the only organisation that exclusively invests into scientific research around mental health. Our vision is to create a world where mental illnesses are understood, effectively treated, and one day prevented. Please leave us a review and let us know what you think about the podcast. Each review helps us reach a wider audience. Visit mqmentalhealth.org to learn more about MQ and mental health research.